The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the New York Times. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, I want to remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we're going to read the last two articles from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic, Indigenous Futures. Now, first, we're going to read an article titled, A Sacred Journey, written by Buryat Mongol Elder Ergin Kamaganova, focusing on stewardship. And he's going to explain how Mongolia is drawing from indigenous values in protecting its land. So let's travel over to Mongolia as we begin our journey. Last fall, Mongolian herder Bazar Losol led our small group of elders through the Altai Mountains. When the afternoon light bathed the rocky cliffs, it revealed a hidden world of petroglyphs depicting ibex, snakes, birds, suns, and moons. All are revered as messengers connecting us to the heavens, the earth, and the underworld. The ancient beauty of the Bayan Undur, or rich heights, mesmerized me. Yet a faint unease settled in. The scene felt incomplete. Then Bazar stepped out of the shadows. The intricate, shimmering patterns of his dark blue deal, a traditional robe, seemed to mirror the patterns etched in stone. In that moment, I understood the source of my restlessness, the absence of people in this sacred place. Unlike the Western view, which often excludes people from landscapes for protection, our tradition emphasizes relationships with nature. Bazar's dignified posture and his deep reverence for this place embody our conservation philosophy, the unbreakable bond joining human nature and culture. This connection is also evident in the tireless work of indigenous groups who designated Bayan Undur Mongolian Transliteration System U's as a community protected area. Because of their dedication, these treasures remain largely unspoiled. This deep connection to our land fuels Mongolia's progressive conservation efforts. 3 decades ago, after the collapse of the socialist order, the country returned to its indigenous roots and adopted a pioneering plan to protect 30% of its land. Long before the United Nations endorsed a similar 30-by-30 target in 2022 to safeguard 30% of the planet's land and water by 2030. Over the past few years, Mongolia has dramatically expanded its protected areas, now covering about 21% of the land, positioning it among world conservation leaders. The forces of globalization affect Mongolia, no different from other countries, and it faces formidable environmental challenges like mining, overgrazing, and habitat loss. Yet Mongolians hold a powerful asset. By embracing traditional values of reciprocity, spiritual connection, and respect for all life, values shared by indigenous peoples worldwide, Mongolia can lead by example. Bazar, our host and guide, holds a revered position within the Elders' Council of the World Union of Indigenous Spiritual Practitioners, an alliance of traditional knowledge holders working together to protect Mother Earth. We, a small group of WUISP members, were embarking on a pilgrimage to the land of the snow leopard. In the breathtaking mountains, we gathered for ceremonies to consecrate WUISP's highest honor. This year, the elders chose a jade sculpture we've named the Tear of the Snow Leopard to represent our collective gratitude to Rodney Jackson, an expert on the endangered snow leopard and its ecosystems, who has dedicated more than 40 years of his life to partnering with communities and indigenous peoples in all 12 countries the animal inhabits. Photographer Kiliai Yuan, also known as a.k.a. Kiliai Fish, joined us on his pilgrimage, his lens capturing the profound beauty and spiritual significance of the journey. While some communities hide their sacred practices, we believe now is the time for openness. Sharing our ceremonies can inspire critical reflection on humanity's connection to nature, challenge current approaches, and foster new perspectives. Bayan Batrik Erden Netsak, Baya for short, led our ceremonies, acting as a mediator among humans, spirits, and nature. Though anthropologists use shaman, a word of Tungusic origin, to define the phenomenon, in Mongolian culture our traditional belief system is called Bu Mergul, which involves communication with spirits, nature, and ancestors for guidance and healing. We worship the eternal blue sky as our highest deity and Mother Earth as a source of life. Despite influences from Buddhism, other religions, and atheism, Bu Mergul remains an integral part of Mongolian identity, particularly in nomadic communities. Baya, at 39, the youngest member of the WUISP's Council of Elders, directed our pilgrimage to the heart of the snow leopard's domain, seeking the blessing needed for the jade miniature. Reaching the road's end, we abandoned our vehicles and clambered awkwardly onto horses. A challenging ascent was the final hurdle before the blessing ceremony. When we reached the plateau, we set up camp beneath the watchful gaze of Sutai Kirkan, a magnificent glacial peak in one of Mongolia's 12 state-worshipped mountains, which the president honors with special ceremonies every 4 years. Amid the awe-inspiring landscape, Baya opened a sacred place with an invocation of the local deity, the guardian spirit of the mountain. We then united in prayer for the well-being of all life, for peace and harmony. Our voices carried through the crisp air, expressing our gratitude to Mother Earth and seeking the continued benevolence of the eternal blue sky. Much to our astonishment, Baya brought with him an unlikely contribution, watermelons. This playful offering aimed to charm the local spirits, echoing the old Mongolian expression, Bagaya Argada, which translates to coax nature. Even though the spirits typically favor typically or locally produced food, and watermelons are not native to Mongolia, Baya argued that this unconventional gift was more than appropriate, for the powerful spirits of the mountains are sometimes like curious and mischievous children. Perhaps they gazed with amusement upon the watermelons tumbling down the Manhan Cliffs the following day, bursting over the white snow with green and pink, covering the valley with seedy blessings. Ceremonies are conservation. That is their purpose and their power. Baya's ceremony and the deep joy and bliss it evoked in all participants demonstrates this truth. Only by embracing place-based indigenous wisdom can we possibly hope to protect our shared past and humanity's shared future. Well, next we conclude our series from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic with an article titled Rising Stars on the Prairie. Now, the writer is Tim Landis, and he's going to reveal how Native American cultures have become filmmakers by building a thriving hub for talent in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Tim's Midtown Diner in Tulsa, Oklahoma, used to be just the local Greasy Spoon, where I could get a big waffle and a hot coffee any day of the week. But since appearing on FX's Peabody Award-winning series Reservation Dogs, it's become a bit of a pilgrimage spot. FX and National Geographic Partners are part of the Walt Disney Company, and that's put in parentheses. Partners are part of the Walt Disney Company, and in one memorable scene, actors Ethan Hawke and Coentahira Deviri Jacobs Mohawk sit across from each other at a table a few feet from where I'm dining. It brings a lot of people in, my server said of the show, created by the Tulsa-based showrunner Sterling Harjo Muskogee Seminole and Oscar-winning filmmaker Taika Waititi Maori. Res Dogs tells the story of four indigenous teenagers coming of age on a reservation in northeast Oklahoma. After a local red carpet premiere, the series debuted in August 2021. Then suddenly on my TV screen, there were native kids I could have hung out with in high school in a neighborhood that could be one outside my window. It was authentic and heartfelt, and a world away from the stereotypical depiction of natives living in teepees and riding horseback. Res Dogs proved that native stories told by native storytellers could succeed on pop culture scale. 2 months later, my social feeds were filled with images of kids and teenagers dressed up as the show's characters for Halloween. Most significant, the series sparked a native filmmaking boom centered in Tulsa. Fittingly, the city sits at the meeting point of three nations, Cherokee, Muskogee, and Osage. The show's three seasons showcase Oklahoma's varied landscapes, from the green Ozark Hills and the rivers that flow throughout the Cherokee Nation's 7,000 square miles, to the prairies in the central region, to the Great Salt Plains in the north, and the mesas near the Panhandle. Okmulgee, the Muskogee Nation capital, stood in for the teen's fictional hometown of O'Kern. Then there is Tulsa itself, a metropolis of more than a million people, with an Art Deco skyline that dates back to the early 1900s, when the city was known as the oil capital of the world. Some downtown locations subbed for Los Angeles in Res Dogs. They also show up in the Martin Scorsese epic Killers of the Flower Moon, which was largely filmed nearby on the Osage Nation Reservation. Harjo employed local crew, many of them inexperienced at the time. He also inspired other indigenous creatives to come to town, including writer-director Erica Tremblay, Seneca Cayuga, and who filmed the Sundance favorite Fancy Dance throughout the area with actor Lily Gladstone, Namupu Sikaskai Sitiapi. Now, Gladstone, who was nominated for an Oscar for her role in The Killers of the Flower Moon, also appeared in Res Dogs. Now, in 2022, seeing an opportunity, my tribe, the Cherokee Nation, became the first in the United States to launch a film incentive program. The initiative provides financial backing for the use of indigenous cast and crew, as well as film locations on the reservation. That same year, Cherokee Film opened a 27,000-square-foot studio on the reservation in Osceola, less than 15 minutes from Tulsa International Airport. The soundstage sitting on the side of the highway is converted indoor soccer facility. A second soundstage spanning 10,000 square feet is being built next door. In 2 years, the tribe has invested more than $10 million in its film office and incentive program. Cherokee Film maintains an online database of native talent and crew with more than 2,000 verified listings. Among them is local Cherokee filmmaker Jeremy Charles, who operates Pursuit Films, a production services provider for local shoots and for tribes across the continent. The Cherokee Film Studio offers motion picture, mixed reality, and 3D capabilities. There is no technology like this in the region, much less available to native filmmakers, Charles says. Working as a native in the industry, I really feel fortunate that Cherokee Film is leading the way for Indian country. There are more projects on the horizon. Choctaw filmmaker Kyle Kawika Harris, who earned numerous awards in 2017 for his Standing Rock documentary I Stand, the Guardians of Water, filmed the crime drama Out of Exile here in 2021 with support from Pursuit Films. Harris and Pursuit will team up again for the action thriller Huntsman, set to be filmed in Oklahoma this summer. And soon Harjo and Hawk will reunite to shoot a pilot for FX, the Tulsa noir, The Sensitive Kind. These days, I'm often detoured around film sets as I drive around town. Once I had to go elsewhere for a cup of coffee so Sylvester Stallone could be filmed sipping an espresso for the Paramount series Tulsa King. Another time, I had to reroute through the downtown because the actor Jesse Plemons was pretending to escort a criminal out of a building for Killers of the Flower Moon. Tulsa used to be a ghost town for creatives. Now look at us. Everyone wants to come here and be part of it, Charles says. The talent is clearly here. You can fully book an entire movie with 100% native talent. You've come a long way. Now we have to work. Now, accompanying Tim Landis' article is a short sidebar. This is called On Location in Osage Nation. It offers some tips for those who might want to tour this budding film industry section and see what's been developed on the reservation. The Academy Award-nominated Killers of the Flower Moon, about the murders of Osage people in the 1920s, was filmed in and around Tulsa and on the Osage Nation Reservation. Guided tours of filming locations began in the Tall Chief Theater in Fairfax, an hour northwest of Tulsa. Reserve at tallchieftheater.com/takeaction. Again, that's tallchieftheater.com/takeaction. Developed by tribal member and the late Joe Connor, and now led by his widow Carol, the tour conveys Osage history and culture at stops that include the historic Masonic Lodge. Now, for self-guided tours, begin your exploration at the Osage Nation Museum in Pawhuska, about an hour north of Tulsa. Pawhuska is the capital of the Osage Nation. In addition to visiting film locations, stop at some of the native-owned small businesses in town, such as Saucy Calf, a new native food restaurant from Osage citizens Asa Cunningham Concha and Jameson Concha. Now, Big Ring Gallery focuses on native art, founded by Osage citizens Addie Runhorse and Joe Jones. The tribe offers lodging at the nearby Osage Casino. Respect the tribe's wishes and don't visit Gray Horse Cemetery, where the victims of the Reign of Terror are buried. Now, for more insight on this, visit OsageCulture.com. That's OsageCulture.com. Well, next on Armchair Traveler, we're going to go trekking 85 miles with Grandpa and scuba diving with Grandma. This article appeared in the August 19, 2024 issue of the New York Times and was written by Julie Reed. With older adults staying fit longer, many are joining their grandchildren on travel adventures like wilderness hikes, bike tours, and even bungee jumping. Now let's go to the main part of Julie's story. Rick Rhodes, 80, was training like crazy last spring, walking 6 miles a day, all hills, to get ready for his summer vacation. Mr. Rhodes of Orcas Island, Washington, and Lucy Arendt, his 15-year-old granddaughter, who lives in Prague, were planning to trek 85 miles in 8 days along Scotland's West Highland Way. The route, which passes through farmland and forest and runs along Loch Lomond into the Scottish Highlands, traverses a range of terrains, including steep inclines and rocky trails. A trip organizer was set to manage lodging and transport the luggage each day. Mr. Rhodes wasn't daunted by the distance or by the age difference. He said he was looking forward to continuing discussions the pair had on video calls on topics as varied as stage drama, cosplay, pandemics, and family dynamics. "I'll get her to go do the talking. We're going up the hills," he says. Well, when they finally did the trek in early July, there were a few wrinkles. The hiking was tougher than expected, and one of Mr. Rhodes' boots began to fall apart near the end, nothing some duct tape wouldn't fix. Overall, Mr. Rhodes said the adventure was challenging, but he was eager to do another, perhaps a route that passed by cafes. 60 or maybe may or may not be, rather, the new 40, but it's clear that many older adults are enjoying longer health spans the time they are active, fit, and healthy. This shift is adding a new dimension to traditional grandparents' grandchild vacations, adventure. Think bike trips instead of cruise ships, wilderness treks instead of bus tours. According to the World Health Organization, healthy life expectancy, defined as the average number of years a person can expect to live in full health without disabling illnesses or injuries, they rose globally to 63.7 in 2019 from 58.3 in 2000. In the United States, 40% of people 65 and older interviewed last year in an Outdoor Foundation study said they engaged in outdoor activities like hiking or biking. Older adults are also now more likely to be able to afford vacations. Americans 55 and older control about 70% of U.S. household wealth, compared to about 50% in 1989. Travel companies are taking notice. Kraft Travel, a luxury trip planner that handles about 150 itineraries per year, has seen a big increase in grandparent-grandchild travel over the past 5 years, said Julia Carter, its founder, adding that the trend has definitely been more toward adventurous or bucket list type experiences. That would include African safaris, hikes in Patagonia, and trips to Antarctica, for example. Now, tour companies and activity providers, which generally don't impose age caps on their offerings, though some have minimum age requirements, are making accommodations for the new demographic. Now, here's some examples. The Jean-Michel Cousteau Resort in Sutasuvo, Fiji, which offers a snorkel and scuba outing, has had grandchildren with grandparents as old as 84 learn to scuba dive together. For guests older than 70, along with the standard safety training, the resort provides a doctor to certify the diver's health. Road Scholar, a travel company, and by the way, that's spelled R-O-A-D, a travel company that was founded to serve older adults and now has an online catalog dedicated to grandparent-grandchild travel, details the physical expectations of its trips so participants can decide if they can handle them. The description of its whitewater rafting trip to the Lower Salmon River in Idaho, for example, tells travelers they'll be carrying bags in camp across uneven terrain. Temperatures can often be in the 90-plus degree range. Backroads, which offers multi-generational biking, hiking, snorkeling, and kayaking trips, sends training advice in advance of departure. Like many other bicycle trip organizers, Backroads makes e-bikes available with a typical minimum age set in the mid-teens. Some grandparents use e-bikes to keep up with the grandchildren, but depending on everyone's fitness level, it may be the younger generation using them, said Liz Einbinder, a Backroads spokeswoman. Some older adults are embarking on more extreme adventures. Nick Steers, the executive director of Great Canadian Bungee, which hosts more than 10,000 guests per year in Chelsea, Quebec, for bungee jumping, zip lining, and rafting, said nearly 5% of its participants were 60 or older, including some grandparents there with their families. Ron Jones, the founder of Bungee America outside Los Angeles, said that in July, a 15-year-old had jumped with his grandparents. Active grandparents have some tips for others considering an adventure vacation with their grandchildren. Preparation for any trip is key, said Joe Bassett, age 60, who runs the guided wilderness adventure company Valiant Outfitters. He takes his grandchildren, the oldest of whom is 7, on hikes and overnight stays. For a camp out, he said, a grandparent might want to walk the trail in advance to make sure they know its contours. An ideal route would be a loop that is never more than a couple of miles from the parking lot, he said. Mr. Bassett advises no cook meals, keep it simple with familiar foods, he said. Now, Harriet Vogel, age 84, of Palm City, Florida, also has some advice. Choose activities you both enjoy, then have hopes rather than expectations, and just let the trip happen, she said. When she was 79, Ms. Vogel celebrated her grandson Matthew's college graduation by snorkeling, paddleboarding, and biking with him in the Caribbean nation of St. Kitts and Nevis, all mutual interests. Last year, it was her granddaughter Jessie's turn, and the two went on a walking and hiking trip in Switzerland organized by Backroads. Ms. Vogel is currently planning a fall trip with another grandchild. The time together increases our closeness, she said. While many grandparents may be ready to go on adventures with their grandchildren, not all of them are eager to deal with technology to do so. When Finn Expeditions in Cocoa Beach, Florida noticed an increase in multi-generational groups going out on its kayaking tours, management made sure to offer reservations over the phone for those who don't like dealing with websites. But that kind of help wasn't necessary for Fran Doran, 79, of Butte, Montana, who took her granddaughter scuba diving in Thailand this summer as a graduation gift. I organized it and made all the reservations online, Mrs. Doran said. The pair also rode in a bamboo boat and waded with elephants in a river. It's fun to research, she said. Well, we're going to wind up today's journey with a walk in the park, 3,000 feet up, I might add. The writer is Casey Richter, and it's a question and answer article featured in the August 20th, 2021 issue of the New York Times. Have you ever taken in a natural vista, say the soaring ranges of a national park, and thought, 3,000 feet of nothingness between me and the ground could really improve this? Well, for Brennan Yeh, a 24-year-old professional slackliner, such an experience is quite literally a walk in the park. Ms. Yeh shares her aerial escapades regularly with her 1.7 million followers in her TikTok account, Yeh Slacks, that's Y-E-H-S-A-S-L-A-C-K-S, Yeh Slacks, while dressed in overalls and polarized sports sunglasses, which she says she loses regularly. Well, slacklining is growing in popularity thanks to video platforms like TikTok and YouTube, and differs from tightrope walking. It uses a flat piece of webbing with some elasticity instead of a steel cable or rope. Now, Ms. Yeh's most popular TikToks tend to show two kinds of slacklining. One is the gleeful bouncing on a slackline stretched a few feet above ground, often on an sun-drenched beach in Santa Monica, California. Now, the style of slacklining in these videos is called trick lining, performing maneuvers on the line that she sets to buoyant pop choruses. One to the soundtrack of Cardi B's Up was reposted by the rapper and has so far gained 45 million views on TikTok. The second type of slacklining favored by Miss Ye is highlining. Miss Ye will work, she will walk, rather, a taut line anchored hundreds of feet up between two cliffs. She has walked over crashing waves in San Luis Obispo, California, against the backdrop of the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco, and with Hong Kong cityscape behind her peeking behind fog. Now, if your stomach flips watching it, know that she always highlines with other experienced slackliners while hooked to two safety lines, and she admits she falls a lot. Now, to understand how she developed such a passion for aerial antics, we recently talked to Miss Ye in a video chat from her home in Los Angeles. The interview was edited for clarity and length. Question, how did you get into slacklining? Answer, when I was 13, I saw it at my local rock climbing gym in the Bay Area. One day, I just saw someone doing tracklining, so they are basically bouncing up and down, and I was immediately like, I have to do that. And then the next thing you know, I'm training every single week all throughout high school. Within that first year, I think by the time I was 14, I was sponsored by the biggest slacklining company out there, Gibbon Slacklines, then Slackline Industries, and traveling the U.S. and the world and competing. Question. Children cycle through many different hobbies. How has slacklining held your attention for 11 years? Answer, growing up, I always did a lot of different sports. I skated, I snowboarded, I dove in high school, but I was always a jack of all trades, master of none. But slacklining was one of those sports where it really taught me that any person can be good at anything if they put their time into it. When you're looking at a slack line, it's one piece of rope, and every single person who starts out slacklining can't walk the slack line. I couldn't even walk the slack line the first time I started. Then, within a couple of months, I was able to walk it. Question, what is a common misperception that people have about slacklining? Answer, they don't have balance, and they can't try it. I don't expect anyone to get on the slack line the first time and be able to walk it, because there are these stabilizing muscles in your legs that you don't really use for anything else other than a sport like slacklining. So when you put the time and effort into it, you'll build up those muscles and you'll be able to walk it. Do you need a super strong core? It's a lot of upper body strength. My arms will actually get really, really tired. When I fall, I have to climb up the leash and use the maneuvers to try to get back up on the line, and then the core muscles when you're trying to balance. Describe your experience taking slacklining out of the gym and onto the high line. Well, when highlining, everything in your body is telling you not to do this because it doesn't make sense. You're dangling yourself hundreds of feet above the air. What about that is normal? Once you're able to walk and be able to take in the surroundings from this crazy angle that nobody else in the world has been able to do, it's the most magical feeling. It's this euphoria. You're focusing on your breath. It's like, wow, meditation almost. How did the pandemic disrupt what you were doing? Well, when you're slacklining, you're out in the middle of nowhere, right? So you don't have to worry about being around large groups. So how do you actually rig a highline? Well, never go highlining unless you're with an experienced person who knows how to rig highlines. Always go with a team of people that you know you can trust and have done this before. Where's a special place that slacklining has taken you? Well, I think the most special time that I was able to get was on Yosemite. It was rigged approximately 3,000 feet in the air, and that was the highest one I can ever done. And her final advice for those who want to try it, you can do it. Don't look at me as someone that's untouchable, because I'm not. Go buy a slack line online. Go set it up in a park. Try to walk it. If you want to do something, go do it. Always search for fun, she says. And that, my friends, is the end of today's journey on Armchair Travel. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any questions or comments, you may direct them to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.